Welcome to Under Lock and Key, news and commentary about prisons from the Revolutionary Anti-Imperialist League. Prison populations may already be skyrocketing, but states are finding new ways to reincarcerate prisoners after their sentences are up.
Amir Abu-Jamal writes about ineffective defense attorneys.
Supreme Court protects warrantless searches, and American cops single out oppressed nationals. The U.S. incarcerates a greater percentage of its population than any other country, sending more black men to prison than to college. The purpose of this program is to educate about and inspire activism against the American lockdown. At the end of May, the Minnesota Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Sexually Dangerous Persons Act, a legislative amendment allowing the state to commit so-called sex offenders in state hospitals after their prison sentence ends. It is up to the discretion of state-employed psychologists and caseworkers to determine whether or not a person is dangerous enough to warrant gaining what is obviously an extended prison sentence by another name. The Minnesota court ruled that the act does not violate due process under either the United States or Minnesota constitutions. This reactionary decision follows an April move by Missouri's House of Representatives to pass a bill that allows the Attorney General's office to review the cases of violent sexual offenders who have already been freed and have them recommitted. If recommitted, they would be incarcerated within state prisons in treatment programs run by the State Department of Mental Health. Laws surrounding sex offenders are ostensibly based on evidence of disproportionate recidivism for these crimes and the heinousness of sexually abusing children. But using Justice Department statistics, the National Center on Institutions and Alternatives points out that persons convicted of sex offenses have lower rates of recidivism than other crimes, and children, who these laws are supposed to protect, are at much greater risk of sexual abuse from family members than from strangers in their neighborhoods. The majority of the offenders, especially if they are white and protected by middle-class, unrestrained parental power, are never caught. The patriarchal family and an imperialist culture that sexualizes children and eroticizes power is the real danger the public should be notified about. The first state to enact legislation committing sex offenders past their prison sentences was Washington in 1990. Throughout the decade, other states have adopted similar measures. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of indefinite civil commitment of sex offenders in 1997 in Kansas v. Hendricks, if it was for the purpose of treatment. Currently, at least 18 states have such laws. Other state laws literally make it impossible for freed sex offenders to leave prison at all. So-called community notification laws, which force convicted sex offenders to register with the police, have their names publicized in neighborhoods, school districts, and increasingly on the internet, make it impossible to find safe housing. If landlords will even agree to rent, notified communities can quickly become lynch mobs. We read recently of a Wisconsin prisoner still living in prison after his release date because no landlord would rent him an apartment. Civil libertarians like the ACLU correctly oppose sex offender registries and post-incarceration confinement as violations of due process of law, and said that they open the door for the state to air and publicize all past criminal acts in public. MIM further opposes the psychologizing of gender oppression inherent in sex offender-specific laws mandating treatment and empowering psychologists to extend prison sentences in hospitals. Such treatment, incorrectly based on the individual and not on the social ill of child sexual abuse, is also used as a tool of lifelong state supervision and surveillance. In a 1996 MIM Notes article, we wrote about the proliferation of Megan's laws requiring sex offenders to register with the state. The article concluded, "All of this legislating and posturing will not stop the abuse of children, a group highly sexualized in this society. In a culture in which power is eroticized, children are common victims of sexual violence since they are the most powerless group in society. This sexualization of children is obvious in pornography and general media representation. The sex offender scare tactics reinforce incorrect analyses of rape, including rape of children. This use of gender to beef up the police state is a trademark of pseudo-feminism. Pseudo-feminists make gender the principal contradiction and ignore the ramifications of legislation they advocate has for oppressed national minorities. If you want to stop crime, rape, and child abuse, there is only one answer. It's not more police in prisons. It's a revolution to transform society." Mumia Abu-Jamal is a former Black Panther on death row in Pennsylvania. He was framed and put on death row because of his outspoken exposure of oppression of black people. Next, we will play an introduction by Judy Berry and then a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal. Judy Berry, an Earth First activist who was critically injured in a 1990 FBI bombing of the car she was driving in, died in 1997.
One of the things that Mumia has overcome is the incredible dehumanization as the system attempts to execute his spirit in preparation for executing his and other prisoners' bodies. For 12 years, Mumia has not touched another human being. He's not allowed contact visits. And he survived this with, as he would say, his aura of resistance intact.
In a case known as Strickland v. Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court drastically narrowed the range of challenges to the effectiveness and competence of counsel at criminal trials. The Sixth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution provides a right in all criminal cases to assistance of counsel. The Sixth Amendment notwithstanding, are people facing imprisonment and severe punishments actually receiving effective and competent assistance of counsel? You decide. If your lawyer actually went to sleep during your trial, would you think he or she was effective? This is what an appeals court ruled in a case called People v. Tippins, 1991. Although defense counsel slept during portions of the trial, the opinion read, counsel provided defendant meaningful representations. What about if your lawyer was high on drugs during the trial? When an appellate court was faced with just such an instance in the case known as People v. Badia, 1990, this was their learned analysis, quote, proof of a defense counsel's use of narcotics during a trial does not amount to a per se violation of constitutional right to effective counsel, unquote. Note, in this case, counsel admitted using heroin and cocaine throughout the trial. And in the case Commonwealth v. Africa, specifically involving moved political prisoner Mike Africa, the trial lawyer later admitted to daily cocaine and marijuana use, but that issue wasn't raised on appeal. It would seem that a fairly competent lawyer, having researched the evidence, would pay some attention to how his client was dressed at trial. Not so, said a court of appeals in the case known as People v. Murphy, 1983. Quote, counsel's seeming indifference to defendant's attire, though defendant was wearing the same sweatshirt and footwear in court that he wore on the day of the crime, did not constitute ineffective assistance, unquote. In all of these real cases, the attorneys involved were deemed competent in their representations, and their client's convictions were upheld. Under these cases, counsel means little more than presence by a lawyer at trial. For even if he is asleep, even if he or she is a drug addict, indeed high at the trial itself, it ain't no thing. Counsel, under Strickland's tortured logic, is presumed effective. This is just a few of the many cases from across the United States that show the poverty of the Sixth Amendment. For more information, you can read Effective Assistance Isn't Much, an article by Roger Darloff in the January-February issue of The American Lawyer. Increasingly, the amendments to the U.S. Constitution are merely filler for dusty history books which have no application in real life, as the courts have shown repeatedly. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.